and welcome to a new series that will be part of the Stats Podcast. Every 2 months, we will discuss the featured article of the current edition of the Baylor University Medical Center Proceedings, the peer-reviewed journal of Baylor Scott & White Health. The editor of Proceedings is Dr. James Fleshman, who is Chief of Surgery at Baylor University Medical Center and Professor of Surgery at Texas A&M College of Medicine, Dallas. This series is also sponsored by Dr. Harry T. Papaconstantino, who holds the Glenn E. and Rita K. Roney Endowed Chair in Surgery and is Professor and Chair of the Department of Surgery at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center in Temple, Texas. The featured article for the May edition of Proceedings is Uterus Transplantation, What the World's Religions Have to Say, by lead author Dr. Liza Johannesson. Accompanying the article is an invited commentary by Dr. Mike Mullender, Chief Mission and Ministry Officer at Baylor Scott & White Health. Dr. Johannesson, an MD and PhD, who is with us today, is Medical Director of Uterus Transplantation at Baylor University Medical Center, the program which she began in 2017 after being recruited from Sweden, where she was instrumental in the first birth after uterus transplantation in the world. Today, the program at BUMC is the largest and most successful uterus transplant program in the world. She is also active in numerous organizations that advance uterus transplantation worldwide. Dr. Johannesson, thanks for being here today to talk about your latest article.
Thank you for having me.
As mentioned earlier, this article is about religious perspectives on uterus transplantation. Before we begin the discussion of religion, can you give us a brief description of uterine transplantation and the reason or purpose for it?
Absolutely. So most causes of infertility we can today cure or treat. And for a very long time, up until very recently, the only thing that we couldn't treat was when the uterus was the problem. So when you were born without uterus, or you had a uterus that was malfunctioning, or if you had a uterus that had to be removed, either for gynecological cancer or bleedings after you give birth, then you didn't have an option to become pregnant again. So uterus transplantation that started in Sweden in 2012 and had the first living birth in 2014 has actually been the only treatment that we can offer these women where the uterus is the problem.
To clarify, for someone with what is called absolute uterine factor infertility, IVF and IUI fertility treatments alone are not treatment options.
They are treatment options in a way, because you do become a parent after using those, but it doesn't treat your actual condition. So uterus transplantation is the only way we can treat this so the woman can become pregnant and give birth by herself.
So with this particular infertility diagnosis, the only other options for having children are gestational surrogacy and adoption. And thus, you compare those three things in your article.
Yeah, we choose to compare those three, not because we want to be a competition in between them. So we know very well that adoption and gestational surrogacy are great options where they are available, I should say, because gestational surrogacy is not legal all over the world and not even in all states in the US. But some women will definitely like those options and go for those options. But for some women, they need a third option, and that is the uterus transplantation that we are now offering them.
Along with uterine transplantation, gestational surrogacy, and adoption, what are the other procedures that were included in your research?
So uterus transplantation is actually a long journey for the patient. It starts with a donor surgery, a donation of a uterus, and this can be either from a deceased or a living donor. The living donor surgeries are, at our center, the most common ones, and they are done with a minimally invasive surgery technique. So we have a robotic-assisted surgery. Then there is the transplant surgery itself, and that involves the recipient of the organ. And then this recipient has to go through the postoperative recovery, of course. And around 3 months after she had her surgery, we start doing embryo transfers. So it requires IVF, in vitro fertilization, to become pregnant. And then she goes through pregnancy and delivery with a cesarean section. And then eventually we can take the uterus out, or she can opt to go for a second child and second pregnancy, and then we start the whole procedure over again. But at the end of everything, we do take the uterus out. And that is because we don't want this woman to be on immunosuppressive medication mm-hmm. for the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm. Why research and publish this article now?
So it was very interesting. When we started with a research trial at Baylor, and we had 20 patients that we transplanted and we delivered their babies. But then we felt that we were ready to offer this as a clinical option to more women. And all of a sudden, we were contacted by patients from all over the world. And they were, of course, from different cultural backgrounds. And one group definitely stood out, and that was women which had religious beliefs that imposed barriers to other paths to achieve pregnancy or to achieve parenthood, such as gestational surrogacy and adoption. And we could see, you know, great variability amongst the religions and even within the religions for how they accepted uterus transplantation, and including particularly guidance on how certain steps within the uterus transplantation, most commonly IVF, that could pose barriers in that particular religion. And we realized that we were not equipped in a good way to handle questions, and we knew very little about the different cultural and religious settings that these women came from and how that impacted their decision-making to become a parent. And I want to emphasize that this paper is just an overview and a background information that we have gathered how different religions treat uterus transplantation and consider uterus transplantation. And it's not going to be a substitute for patients consulting their spiritual advisors or their religious authorities for guidance, but to help the patients what questions they should give to those people in their lives to guide them.
When you say that the candidates that you talk to do a large percentage inquire about the religious perspectives?
Yes. So after we opened it up, a lot of our patients or women coming here have religions that has certain impacts or position statements around fertility treatment in general. That's one of the most enlightening parts for us, actually, to understand that infertility is extremely important, not only to the woman itself, but also in the different religions. And they have thought much about that and what they can kind of what they can approve mm-hmm. That goes along with their religious beliefs. So many women ask us about this. So for mm-hmm. us, it was very vital to go through this material and try to figure out for our own sake what the different religions' standpoint was on uterus transplantation.
So at least you can point them in good directions.
Yeah, so we can help them form the questions that they should pose to their spiritual advisors, and to know what to ask for, if that's acceptable in their setting.
Mm-hmm. As far as the literature goes, the first religion to specifically address uterine transplantation was Judaism. Can you share briefly on its position?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. Judaism was one of the three religions, together with Islam and Catholicism, that have addressed uterus transplantation specifically, not only infertility and organ donation, but actually uterus transplantation. And in general, Judaism allows for uterus transplantation, but there are some restrictions that most follow. The first one is that the gametes, the sperm and the egg, needs to be from the married couple that are seeking to procreate. So that means that the husband and the wife coming to us must be able to use their own eggs and sperm. The second thing is that Judaism, when they look at living uterus donation, it's only considered good if the recipient's infertility is considered sufficient serious illness or disability to warrant that the donor is undertaking the risk of the surgery. And that is very subjective to weigh those risks and can vary, of course, from case to case. So often our patients are consulting their rabbis before they come to us, and then they come back to us with an answer. And we have a lot of connections with the rabbis as well to try to figure out what this particular individual needs to go through. The other thing that Judaism looks at for living donation is that for healthy women of childbearing age wanting to donate the uterus, there might be prohibitions that's either biblical or rabbinical against sterilization, and that particularly in more traditional Jewish communities that might pose a problem towards living donation.
Mm-hmm. Islam and Catholicism have also specifically addressed uterine transplantation. Broadly, what are their positions?
So Islam has a very variable opinion on uterus transplantation. donated organs related to fertility that would be including the uterus or sperms or ovaries is typically prohibited. However, since uterus doesn't contain transferable genetic material, some will allow it anyways. So that goes for allowing the donation from living donors. But again, they have regulations regarding sterilization if you're still in childbearing age. So that might prohibit them from donating the uterus. And when it comes to Catholicism, so usually Catholicism judges acts and procedures on if they're morally good or if they can be considered morally good. And an act would then be considered morally good only if the object, the end, and the circumstances are all morally good. And when they interpret uterus transplant, the object would be the restoring of the bodily wholeness, and the end, which is achieving the pregnancy and the live birth, both of those are considered morally good, but the circumstances through how we get there is through IVF. And IVF is in general considered immoral. And that's for two reasons. The first one is because it separates procreation from the conjugal act. And the second one is because it's raising concerns relating to the abandonment or loss or destruction of embryos that you potentially don't use. So both of these religions, Islam and Catholicism, has both pros and cons towards uterus transplantation. What I can add too, that what is special here is that Islam in general doesn't allow for gestational surrogacy. So that kind of brings them closer to the alternative.
For religions that have not addressed the subject specifically, you use the procedures of IVF and organ transplantation to provide insight on what their positions might be. What were some of your findings in this area?
So, yeah, we chose to look at the different parts, and that being then, as you said, IVF, organ transplantation, organ donation, because in most religions, there were no position statements of uterus transplant specifically. And we tried then to look at these three parts to understand what their position may be when you put these together and you actually have uterus transplantation. And overall, I would say that the step that raised most religious controversy is the IVF procedure. And for many religions, that is a key concern, is the creation of spare embryos that we describe for Catholicism, the spare embryos in the IVF, and how we would store them afterwards, and how they potentially would be destroyed if not used. So I would say that that is the step that stands out in uterus transplantation that most religions have some issues with, if they do.
Do you think that doing this procedure without creating spare embryos is a possibility?
Yeah, so the way we have worked around that with some of our recipients is that you can freeze eggs, for example, and then you can create the embryo just before the IVF and do a fresh embryo transfer. We do want to see prior to we actually do the transplantation that there is fertility potential within the couple, because we don't want to put anyone through a uterus transplant, a huge surgery with medications, if there's no potential for them to become pregnant and give birth, because that's the outcome that we want. But we can work around that with looking at the quality of the eggs, the quality of the sperms, and then create the fresh embryos.
What is living uterus donation, and what are some of the religious issues related to it?
Yeah, so several religions actually raise barriers for women of childbearing age to donate their uterus as well. Just as an example that we touched on before, for Catholics, hysterectomy is in general only permitted when there is a grave or present danger to the life or health of the woman, or when the uterus is irreversibly unsuitable for procreation, then you can remove it as well. And similar issues apply to Orthodox Christian women as well. For Islam, there's dual barriers for living donors. First, the donating the organs related to the fertility is generally not allowed. That would include, as we said before, the ovaries, the sperms, and also the uterus in that sense, or fallopian tubes. And second, for these women of childbearing age, is a general position amongst Islamic jurists that forbids sterilization, except when it's justified on serious health grounds. And uterus transplantation is not considered a serious health ground for the donor. because the donors are healthy. They go through some will call it a non-necessary procedure to help this recipient to become pregnant. Mm-hmm.
Regarding the alternate pathways to parenthood that you surveyed in your article?
When you look at gestational surrogacy and adoption, in general, adoption is accepted at a higher rate in most religions than gestational surrogacy is, and it's favored over that alternative. And what's interesting is also that gestational surrogacy is illegal in many countries. Almost all countries in Europe, for example, surrogacy is illegal. And it's legal in some countries in Asia and in some states in the US as well. But not even all the states in the US have legal, surrogacy is a legal option.
Wrapping up, what conclusions do you draw from your research?
You know, the most striking for us was definitely that infertility and the inability to procreate was so important, not only to women and to the couple, but that it was very, very important and had been addressed in almost all the religions we looked at. Most religions have position statements, and some, as we said before, even have it towards uterus transplant directly, specifically, but whereas almost all of them have something written about fertility and IVF and other different options around fertility. The other thing is that we should remember that even if we are now in this paper grouping the religions together, there's huge variability amongst the religions and also within the religion. So even if you're a Jew, you might not adhere to all of those rules and position statements that is written down. But all this is also very confusing to the patients that come to us and to all the providers that's trying to inform their patients about their different options to achieve parenthood. So that's, I think, why we decided to write this paper from the beginning. And it will remain important for us to include like an open and honest conversation with patients interested in uterus transplantation, to take in advice from their spiritual advisors and not exclude that part that is so, so important for them in the way they are living.
Do you anticipate that uterus transplantation will become more available as time goes by?
Yeah, definitely so. So it's a very, very new field and the evolution has been dramatic. It's gone from the first baby was born in 2014 and in the US in 2017. So it's very recent.
Oh, yes.
And now we have 4 centers working with uterus transplant in the US, and we know of at least 5 more that's starting up. And most of these centers are now exiting their clinical trials, their research trials, and are opening up for a wider population. So I anticipate this will be big in the future. The only barrier we have at the moment is the cost of the procedure and the lack of insurance coverage.
Unfortunate.
Very unfortunate. But we're working with the insurance companies and the payers, and we're trying to get at least part of the procedures covered. Because our goal is, of course, that all women should have access to this, not only the wealthy.
Dr. Johannesson, what would you want to say to women who have thought about this as a treatment option?
I think I want to say to them that it's definitely an option. And you should ask your providers to describe not only adoption and gestational surrogacy, demand to hear more about this option as well. Because there are 3 really, really good options for you to become pregnant or become a parent. And you should definitely get the information you can, all the information you can. And I also encourage them to, if they have a religion which they think might be opposed to uterus transplantation or the other 2 options to become a parent, to not give up there. Try to talk to your spiritual advisors and see, because we haven't worked with a single religion so far that is not allowing uterus transplantation. They might not allow or like particular parts of it, but we are always been able to work around that. So don't give up. Contact us and talk to your advisors as well to see what we can do.
Dr. Johannesson, thanks so much for talking with us about your article. It's a fascinating subject. Congratulations on the success of the uterus transplantation program at BUMC, and the best to you as you continue to advance this cutting-edge treatment for infertility.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That concludes this episode of Stats. Be on the lookout for the discussion of the next lead article from Proceedings and for other Stats episodes.